Thanks very much. Thank you. Hope my talk lives up to that introduction. Thank you very much. I would say it's great to be here. I guess I'm always here, but anyway, thank you all for coming. So the first time I gave a talk here, actually, I had a very warm reception, which is part of why I chose to come here. I like low temperature physics and phase transitions and so on. So here's a brief outline of my talk. If you were watching the podcast or something, this would be the 5 minutes you would actually listen to. So first I'm going to tell you about phase transitions. I'm sure everyone's fairly familiar, but in particular I'll focus on quantum phase transitions, transitions that happen at zero temperature as we tune some parameter in the Hamiltonian, in our case in the material, and I'll talk in particular about high temperature superconductors, which were discovered actually about 25 years ago, and yet we still don't fully understand why they superconduct at the temperatures they do, and strangely they actually start as insulators. And we then dope them to be metals, and along the way, they reveal superconductivity. And some people think it's, in fact, this quantum phase transition that generates the superconductivity. Now, you might ask, why is it so hard to answer this question? And part of the reason is that these are complex materials, as I'll show you, and they have a lot of materials issues. And taking them to the superconducting phase usually requires some chemistry, which is not to insult chemists in the audience, but rather to say that it's not as simple as just changing one parameter. You're often changing many things at once. And what we'd like to do is find a way to tune these materials without changing so many parameters simultaneously, and that leads us to want to make thin films in a so-called field effect transistor. So basically make a capacitor out of these materials where we could, with a voltage, simply tune the material from one phase to the other. And of course, that would make fantastic devices if you could tune superconductivity on and off. Okay, so our approach has been to do that with so-called mechanical exfoliation. You probably better know it as the Scotch tape method. It was originally invented for graphene, and we've been using it for a wide variety of materials. The reason we like this approach is, to be honest, despite how generous my startup was, we only need a glove box, which is quite cheap. And we can do it on any substrate we like. So when we make these thin films, as I'll show you, we've been able to make nanometer thick crystals on a wide variety of substrates. So we have porous polycarbonate, we've been able to do it on gold, on hafnia dioxide. So that's really a certain flexibility of this technique, which makes it quite appealing. To look at these materials, we use a wide variety of optical tools. As Henry mentioned, I was actually trained as an infrared spectroscopist. And part of why I got into optics is because you can look at a wide selection of physical effects simultaneously. So we cover a broad range, about 3 decades in energy. And for instance, as shown in this graph, we can actually see a huge number of different properties of a material at once. So this is for magnetic semiconductors, showing that we can look at, say, their band structure or the scattering rate or how many carriers are there, all in one measurement. And so you might imagine with complex materials, this is a really powerful tool to help us figure out which of these physical effects are important for other physical effects that we're looking at. Today, I'll focus mostly on Raman spectroscopy. This is where you send a photon in, it scatters off your sample and creates some bosonic excitation, in particular a lattice vibration, a plasmon, or a magnetic excitation, and therefore your photon either loses or gains energy. And this is quite useful not just for identifying materials, because they all have a unique signature, but again, you get some insight into what's going on underneath. You can look at very small materials, like our nanocrystals, and for instance, in the BISCO compounds, the high temperature superconductors, we've seen a large shift in what is so-called 2-magnon spectrum. And basically, what that means is that somehow the magnetic exchange in this material, the flipping of one spin relative to another, gains energy as we thin them down. And I'll try to explain that to you as we go. I'll then switch gears a little bit and tell you about a new kind of very exciting field in condensed matter called topological insulators. So these are materials that reveal new states, not because of some broken phase transition, not because of some broken symmetry or phase transition, but rather because the topology of the solutions to the Hamiltonian is fundamentally different than it is in vacuum. And because of the sudden change in topology, they reveal a new set of excitations on their surfaces, which, as someone who's been doing something that's really good for bulk probe, is both fun and frustrating. But it's also quite exciting in terms of the number of new things that we might see. And in particular, in our group, we've looked at the Raman scattering of these materials as we thin them down. And what we found is we can see bulk-like excitations, Raman scattering, but as I'll show you, we also see a new additional phonon mode that shows up and comes from the surface of these materials. So we really think we have a new way to get out the surface states. Finally, if I have time at the end, I hope to tell you about some future directions, new projects that are kind of ongoing. So let me, of course, thank a number of people who, without whom this work would be basically not possible. So Yuichi Ando, Shinpei Ono, and Genda Gu all sent us the high-temperature superconductor crystals. Bob Kava from Princeton and Sungwook Chun from Rutgers sent us the bismuth selenide, the topological insulating crystals. Daryl Schlamm and his group sent us some strontium titanate that we've been exfoliating on. Ferry Borendix and Renfei Feng from the Canadian Light Source, we've been working with them on studying these materials, both to do IR microscopy and X-ray, that I'll hope to tell you about at the end. Of course, a lot of people locally, Rich McElhoney and Cynthia Goh, who helped us with the AFM work. We've been working with Youngjun Kim on some of, as I mentioned, looking at the lattice structure of these materials with X-ray. And ZH Liu, who sent us the hafnia dioxide, and Harry Ruda, who's been helping with some of the transport measurements. And of course, the people who do the actual work, my group here. Let me just highlight a few people, in particular Luke Sandilands, who's done a lot of the work on the exfoliation of BISCO that I'll talk about today. Christiana Beekman, who's a postdoc in our group and worked on the exfoliation of topological insulators. Frank Zhao is a fantastic undergraduate in our group who actually is the first author on the topological insulator paper. So if you're an undergrad who wants to work in our group, we're always happy to have you. Anjan Rangers, who's the a graduate student you see here, he was the one who really got our FTIR up and running and has now been taking lots of great topological insulator data with it. Yao Tian, who's been exploring a lot of different substrates for exfoliation. And Parisa Zarapour, who's been doing a lot of this interesting combinations of different materials that I hope to tell you about at the end. Okay, and of course, this would be totally impossible some former members of our group, undergrads who helped us with exfoliation and other things. And maybe I should have said them first, the funding agencies, of course, who pay for all this, and some companies that we've been working with helping us fund our research. Okay, so let me get to the basic idea, right? So different phases of matter. So this is a very old scientific problem, right? Why is it that solids, liquids, and gases have the different properties they do? Right, so if I take water, why do I find it in all these different different cases? And also, if I stick even just to the solid case, why is it that silver and water have such fundamentally different properties? Or why is it that silver has the color that it does versus, say, gold? So this old problem was first attempted by Democritus in 400 BC, and he had the basic idea that, there must be some fundamental particle, which we would, of course, call an atom, which is different in these different materials. Sadly, his ideas were ignored for a long time until Newton came along who said, yeah, there are these atoms, and it's the forces between them that matter, right? So as the forces change, that's what's changing to differentiate a solid from a liquid from a gas. So that's close, right? But really, it's Boltzmann's ideas about statistics that taught us quite a lot about these different phases, right? That what's really going on is, say, in the liquid phase, your molecules of water are basically randomly arranged. There's no broken symmetry there. But as you continue to, say, change the temperature or the pressure, eventually you can get a broken translational symmetry, and they freeze, as we would say, and become a solid, right? And so the fundamental idea is that some symmetry of the system is broken, and the properties will change, right? You get this new phase. So using that fundamental idea, he, of course, was able to show how you can get these phase diagrams, which have so-called order parameters. And this basic physics is not just important in condensed matter, it's important in, say, heat exchange, if you're worried about energy use, or if you're worried about the atmosphere. It's really a fundamental set of ideas that I think are important across the discipline. So one of the aspects of this that I find quite remarkable is that if you look at a phase transition, no matter what the underlying system, if roughly the overall physics is, let me rephrase that. If the physics can seem very different, but the results can be the same. So what I mean is that as I look at water going to gas, I get this fundamental relationship between the temperature and the change in the pressure. On the other hand, if I look at a ferromagnet, as I melt the magnetization, right, as I go through the phase transition from order to disorder, I actually see the exact same relationship for its order parameter, right? So systems that have, you know, very different, underlying physics, microscopic physics, still show the same macroscopic behavior. Now, I haven't yet answered why is it that silver and water are different, right? And that came a little bit later with Paul Druda, who thought about, who was very shy, there we go, who thought about, you know, if I have, what might be different is in metals, I have these extra set of electrons, free electrons. And these electrons can behave as a gas. And if I treat them as a gas, I can then derive what their properties should be. And as a result, he did that using classical mechanics and was able to explain why different metals have different conductivities, have different reflectivities. And that theory actually works pretty well. We still, in some sense, use it with some updates for quantum mechanics, of course. But you might ask yourself, how can that be true, right? The electrons are so close together, you know, there is a very strong Coulomb interaction. How can they behave so independently? And in fact, that bothered this gentleman, Landau, so much. He came up with what we now call Fermi liquid theory, which is really the basis of modern condensed matter. And there he said, actually, the electrons behave as a liquid. And what you're seeing are not sort of electrons themselves, but excitations out of that liquid. And those excitations behave like electrons. We call them quasi-particles. But these quasi-particles, interestingly enough, can behave very differently, right? They can have extremely heavy masses, in up to, say, 1,000 times the free electron mass, or very low masses. But nonetheless, they still behave like electrons. Now, you might have said, well, couldn't I tune these electrons into another phase, right? If I change, again, just like in water, if I change the density or temperature. And in fact, that's true. If you turn up the interactions enough, you can get an insulating phase or of a material, which you might think of as the solid version on this kind of a phase diagram, right? And now you might ask questions like, okay, well, this is all in temperature and sort of a classical picture, right? So let me turn this on its head, the way that us condensed matter people like to look at it, and say, you know, part of the thing that tells you that this is a classical phase diagram is all the phase changes happen at finite temperature, right? But so in other words, they don't ever happen just as a tuning parameter of your Hamiltonian. Now, one interesting consequence of it being classical is as I go through this phase transition, my two phases can coexist in time, but never in space, right? So I always have bubbles in my water, but I never have a region that's, say, both both gas and liquid. Right, so I can get them to coexist in time and not in space. And now I can ask, well, if instead I have a transition that happens at zero temperature, can something new emerge? Right, so in the same way, in a very naive picture, and I'm sure the theorists are going to groan when I say this, but in the same way that an electron can be both a particle and a wave, perhaps a system, when it's at one of these quantum phase transitions, can sort of both be have a piece from each component and generate some new phase. And that's what many of us are interested in trying to look for. So one material in particular that we've sort of, people believe this kind of physics may be going on are these high temperature superconductors. So I'll get into a little bit more detail in a minute how this works, but basically you start with an antiferromagnetic insulator, you dope it, you change the carrier density, and along the way a high temperature superconductor shows up. And just in case you're not that interested in fundamental physics, let me point out, this is also an important application. So for instance, American Superconductor now sells high temperature superconducting wires that are actually 10 times more efficient at transmitting energy than the standard copper wire, right? And that's even when you have to cool them to 90 Kelvin, which you do now. So imagine if we had a room temperature superconductor. Now, many people also believe superconductors could form the basis of, say, a quantum computer and would be useful as qubits for quantum information. And not to mention high-speed rail. If you want to do a monorail, it would be great if we could have room temperature superconductors. So, you know, I think there's a wider range of applications of superconductivity. Okay, but back to being a physicist. So the cuprates, the way they work fundamentally is you have copper and oxygen. You have a plane of copper and oxygen. And at each copper site, there's essentially one electron. And that one electron has a spin, and it turns out that you would expect that should be a metal. But because the electron's repulsion is so high, they would actually rather form this antiferromagnetic lattice. Okay, so the magnetic exchange is so great that it actually would prefer to be in this insulating state, this solid state, if you will. But, you know, we don't like listening to nature, so instead what we do is we start doping the crystal and changing the atoms, and as a result, we can pull out some of the electrons. And when we do that, we get holes. And as we start adding more and more holes to the system, it's like changing the density of the water. We can eventually get this solid to melt and form a metal, right? A gas or a liquid. But along the way, what you find are a variety of phases. So this PG phase is so-called pseudogap. This phase is very strange because depending on how you look at it, in some ways it looks like a metal, in some ways it looks like an insulator, in some ways it has magnetic excitations, in some ways it doesn't. Nonetheless, if you dope enough, you do get this Fermi liquid. Okay? Now, part of what's going on here is that as I add holes, normally I'd expect them to want to be as far apart as possible, right? But if I consider this magnetic background that they sit in, right, if I put two holes next to each other, that means that there's one less magnetic bond that I'm breaking, right? So for a hole by itself, I break 4. For two holes, I break 8. But if I put two together, I only break 6. So it actually, if the magnetism is strong enough, becomes energetically favorable for these holes to lie next to each other. And that results in a wide variety of other phases, so-called stripe phases. And some people believe that it's in fact how you generate the high temperature superconductivity. So are we done after 25 years? Is that it? Is it all explained? And I think part of the problem is no, because even though I've been telling you about this in this beautiful cartoon, right, the problem in some sense is also that if I want to go across this phase diagram, I can't simply just take the material across and put holes in. I have to cook up a new crystal, right? And I love cooks. They're great, especially those who make our crystals, but they're never perfect, right? These crystals always have some disorder. I'm always replacing one atom with another. The lattice is changing. Lots is going on at once, and this problem is hard enough. So what we'd like to do is, first let me remind you that when you see these diagrams, if they say doping with a little p, which is supposed to be hole density, what's really going on is some atom is being replaced, right? So there's another parameter being changed that's just sort of hidden under the carpet. And what we want to do is change that real parameter that the theorists change in their models, their computers, but do it experimentally. So again, the way we want to do that is with a field effect transistor. So we'll put our high temperature superconductor on some insulating layer on a semiconductor, and we've essentially got a capacitor. If we apply a voltage, we can then change the number of carriers in our top layer. Now, of course, most of the carriers are going to pile up at the bottom, so to have any significant amount of difference, what we really have to do is make a very thin film. Okay, so that's what we're after. Now, along the way, there may be some other interesting physics. As I mentioned, it's not just a copper-oxygen layer. In the material I'm talking about today, BISCO, you actually have lots of other layers stacked in there. But more importantly, the question is, can I really think about a sort of fundamental question we don't know? Can I think about an isolated copper-oxygen plane, or do I have to worry about the fact that there's some coupling from plane to plane? So one way to experimentally answer that question, of course, is to just thin the material out and see what changes. Right? Does the material property stay the same, in which case this model of a copper-oxygen plane is fine, or does it change in some fundamental way, which tells me that the coupling between the planes matters? Now, in terms of full disclosure, I should say that some other groups sadly beat us to it. So they have recently grown some thin films and put down some so-called ionic liquid. So this is a liquid where you actually have charges as ions in the material, and as you put a gate voltage on, the ion separates, you can get incredibly high carrier densities. And as a result, they've been able to actually tune these high-temperature superconductors from insulators to metals. However, there are a number of drawbacks of their approach, which, of course, I have to say. So one is, of course, this liquid. So it turns out that if you want to use this liquid, you basically set a voltage, and then you cool down, and you're stuck. So you can't constantly tune the voltage at whatever temperature you might be at. Of course, another problem is you have this liquid sitting there. You have to worry about chemistry happening and what other probes you might be able to use on your material. So for instance, again, they're using thin films, and that means that whatever substrate they have is going to get in the way of whatever optical experiment I might want to do. And often the substrates they choose stink for optics because nature is not kind. Another part of the problem with films, right, is the reason they're on these particular set of substrates and limited to them is because I have to make the atoms match, right? It's like Legos. I have to plug them together. And so really, if you want, the issue is strain. When I put one film down on another material, once they chemically bond, I not only have to worry about whether I can actually grow that material, but if I do, whether that I've somehow changed that film due to strain. So I like to describe the work on oxide thin films as being like a prefixed menu. The food is fabulous, but the options are limited. And sadly, I'm an American. I can't help looking for something more like this. And so that led us to mechanical exfoliation. So let me tell you what that is and how it works. It was invented by these two gentlemen, Andre Geim and Konstantin Novoselov, who, in my opinion, were inspired by MacGyver. Specifically, they took scotch tape, put it together with a pencil that you can't see, sorry, and they got a Nobel Prize. So that's quite an interesting feat. Now, let me tell you why, actually, a lot of people were interested in graphite and graphene. It was actually predicted, I think, in the late 40s here in Canada, that if you could make a single sheet of graphene, right, which is what graphite is made out of, what you would have are these quasi-particles that behave as if they were photons. Their dispersion would be linear. It would be as if they had no mass, which is quite strange, right? And what's more, the Fermi energy should be exactly in a place where these bands would cross. In other words, if I just change the carrier density slightly, I can go from electrons to holes and back. And that's, in fact, what's been seen. So I'm actually showing data from Philip Kim that came out slightly after Geim and Novoselov. So here he's got a graphene device sitting on SiO2 on silicon, so it's an FET. And as they change the gate voltage, they see the resistivity peak right at zero, which is where your Fermi energy is, right at this so-called Dirac point. And what's more, they also see that they can change the sign of the Hall voltage, which is telling them they go from electrons to holes. Perhaps exciting from an application standpoint, but also it's proof of this linear dispersion, and well, not exactly, but it's sort of evidence for it, is the very high mobilities they got. So these are some of the first devices, and they already had mobilities of 10,000, which are just enormous, right? People worked years and years and years to get those kind of mobilities in gallium arsenide. And so that means you could make devices out of this that switch very fast. So that, in fact, rumor has it, now Samsung's coming out with a device next year. We'll see what happens. Having said that, there's been a lot of interest from the community, I think it's fair to say, including some people locally here, in this material. Nonetheless, I think most people missed something kind of interesting in the second paper of Geim and Novoselov. So they published a paper in PNAS sort of describing this method in detail, and one of the things they showed is not only that you can do it for graphite, but you can do it for many other materials. Niobium diselenide, which has a so-called charge density wave and is also a superconductor. Molybdenum disulfide, which is an indirect gap semiconductor. And for the purposes of this talk, BISCO2212, a high-temperature superconductor. And interestingly, there's this one line in their paper where they say, you know, we exfoliated it, we made contacts, and it's insulating. That's it. Which is a very bold statement with which... Right? It could mean that, in fact, if you had a single layer of copper oxygen, no matter how doped it was, it would be an insulator. That would be kind of a very fundamental result. Sadly, they didn't do anything to check whether it was just chemistry. So that's kind of where we came in and said, let's give it a try and find out what happens. Now, another advantage of this technique is that if you want to grow all these different films, again, you don't need some million-dollar complicated MBE machine and spending a year of your life just turning it on. You can instead use a different set of tools for exfoliation. Tough crowd. Okay, so actually, this is the real set of tools that we use. So this is my student Yao. So this is actually our new glove box. So we used to have another one that Joseph kindly lent us. So basically, for us, we can do this with a very simple process, right? But nonetheless, we're trying to make these materials as clean and as good as we can, and that's part of why we do it in this way. So what we do is we take our substrates and we bake them in this dry atmosphere to get all the water off. We then take our bulk crystal, place it between two pieces of scotch tape. We rip the scotch tape apart and we get a nice shiny surface. We take that shiny surface and we, if you want, stamp it on some substrate. And there's a very special rubbing technique that I can't tell you about because we've copyrighted it. And then you lift off and go hunting. And this is what you find. So this is a piece of a high-temperature superconductor of two different thicknesses sitting on SiO2 silicon. This is a much thinner piece, 13 nanometers thick, more than 20 microns across. Here's another set of pieces, 42 and 160 nanometers. We do lots of checks. So for instance, we always do AFM, and we find that they have very flat surfaces and very sharp interfaces, which is part of how we know that what's going on is we're literally, our substrate is peeling away a piece of the bulk crystal. And that's what's left behind. Now, I should say that that isn't always what happens. Sometimes chemistry gets the better of us, and they go bad, and we can actually see that in the topography. It starts to get very rough. Now, you may have noticed that the color is changing with thickness. This is actually a fairly trivial effect. It turns out because you're sitting on SiO2 silicon, you don't just get reflections from the top surface, you're also getting a Fabry-Perot effect. And that's what allows you to see the change in the thickness simply by looking under the microscope, if you will. Poor man's AFM, I guess. And I'll just say quickly that we've actually checked that that you can calculate this Fabry-Perot effect, and it more or less works pretty well. So we wanted to check that these materials really are still BISCO, right? How do we know that, again, chemistry hasn't gotten the better of us and something fundamental has changed? That led us to optical spectroscopy, and here's the part where I convince you that your startup dollars were well spent. So this is a quick tour of my lab. If you'd like a real tour, please contact me. I'm happy to show you around. So first, we have a Raman microscope, which is a 532 excitation laser. We can cover about, 2 MeV to about 3/4 of an EV in shift. I'm going to skip the rest of it because I'll show you more later. This is our FTIR setup. It's quite unique. We can measure reflection, transmission, photoconductivity, and photoreflectance all in one setup from about 10 Kelvin to about 400 Kelvin. And we could also, in principle, gate materials at the same time. We also just recently received a 9 Tesla split coil magnet. You may have noticed it has this nice hunkin' thing on top. That is actually a cryogen-free system. So there's actually no cryogens in the magnet, which I think the students will appreciate. I'm not sure if more than me, since they aren't paying the bills. But nonetheless, it's really you flip a switch and you're ready to go in a few days. OK, and then finally, we share with Yongjun Kim an ellipsometer that allows us to look at a variety of optical properties of thin materials. So as I mentioned earlier, part of the reason we do this is so that we can cover a wide spectrum of different properties. You know, by covering this huge range in energy, both in, say, magnetic semiconductors, but also in high-temperature superconductors, we can really see a wide variety of things at once and hope to find out which of them is important for whatever new phase might emerge. So since not everyone's a spectroscopist, some good rules of thumb, 8,000 wave numbers is about 1 electron volt. 1.5 EV is about 800 nanometers, in case you like wavelength. Some other advantages of our techniques, we don't have to make contacts, which I've come to appreciate more and more each day. So we can really probe our materials without having to worry about how the contacts are affecting them or whether we're probing the contacts themselves. If we have thin films, we can learn about things like surface roughness. How rough is the surface? Is there an oxide layer? We can also determine if it's a thin film, how thick is that film layer? How do the interfaces look? And not to be outdone, of course, we also look at bulk crystals. And in fact, this is a sample that Anjan has measured on its AC face that is only slightly thicker than a human hair. So you can actually see that human hair on the right-hand side. OK, so the technique that I'm going to focus on today is Raman scattering. So I'm not going to tell you the interesting story of how Raman discovered it. But basically, he took sunlight, he focused it down, he put it through a polarizer, he put it through a filter, so he had a single wavelength. And then he scattered it off a material. And when you do that, that photon can then scatter and create either an electrical excitation, a plasmon, a magnetic excitation, or a phonon. And in addition, you can look at this photon that comes off to see the energy scale involved with whatever it is that you've kicked into the system. Or you can look at the polarization dependence and learn things about like the symmetry of whatever mode you've created. Now, thankfully, every material has a unique set of spectrum, and that's been quite interesting from, let's say, a law enforcement perspective. It's not really what we were after. We were more interested in whether our BISCO is BISCO. So let me show you the BISCO spectrum. So this is a spectrum now in black of an underdoped BISCO crystal, bulk crystal, and in red of our substrate, silicon on silicon dioxide. And you'll notice they look quite different, but let me walk you through the spectrum. At the lowest energies, you're seeing single phonon excitations. These are lattice vibrations. At slightly higher energies, you're seeing a so-called two phonon, or if you want, joint density of states of the phonon. So this is where, to conserve momentum, what you do is you create a phonon at plus Q and at minus Q. The momentum cancels out, but now you can run over all Q. And finally, at higher energies in the BISCO, you're seeing a so-called two magnon excitation. So let me try to explain what that means. So here is, again, in the parent compound, the copper-oxygen plane. And you can think of it as a Heisenberg anti-ferromagnet. So if I flip a single spin relative to another spin, it should cost me J over 2, because I'm at spin 1/2. For if I create just one magnon, I've broken 4 magnetic bonds, that should cost me 2J, right? Now, we can't really flip the spin with light, and so what we do instead is flip 2 spins. And the net result is we don't change the total momentum, and now we create 2 magnons going in opposite Q, okay? And we would expect that that should cost us 4J. It turns out that it's not quite that simple, because if I were to flip them next to each other, these nearest neighbors, then I don't break the magnetic bond in between. As a result, it only costs me 3J to do that, and this is actually the excitation that we see. So this is kind of useful, not just interesting in the sense that we can measure the magnetic excitation strength, but also it's a fairly local probe, right? We're looking at 2 spins flipping next to each other. So for instance, as we start doping the material and removing spins, we would expect this excitation to broad out and go to lower energies. And that's exactly what's seen. So here's some data from Sugai et al. On bulk BISCO. So the lowest spectrum there is actually an overdoped crystal. The highest one is a heavily underdoped. And what you'll notice is that as you go from the very doped crystal, where the magnetic excitations are quite broad and weak, they strengthen and sharpen as I go to the underdoped. So I'm more and more in this parent compound. So this also suggests that one can use this 2-magnon as a way to look at the doping level in your crystal. So what happens when we exfoliate? So here's a bulk spectrum that I'm showing you. Again, you see the phonons, the 2-phonon, and the 2-magnon. And at first, we were exfoliating on silicon dioxide and silicon, and that was fine, except that it meant that we could never see the phonons because we were just swamped by the substrate. So we went ahead and exfoliated on gold, and this is the spectrum that we got. And the magnon part is exactly the same as SiO2 on silicon. That was good. But it's clearly quite different from the bulk, right? So what we see is that the low-energy phonons all match up perfectly, which is great. It means that, in fact, we still have BISCO. The lattice is intact. But nonetheless, this 2-magnon feature has clearly hardened and shifted, right, and grown in strength. And so what we believe is happening is that as you thin out the material, there's some extra oxygen in this material, which is well-known, and is actually where the dopants come from. And we believe those extra oxygen are essentially leaving the material as you thin it down. As a result, the doping level changes quite dramatically. Now, that would not only explain our data, but it also explains why Gaiman and Novoselov saw this insulating BISCO crystal when they measured it. Okay, let me try as best I can to switch gears and tell you about topological insulators. So I just want to, this is a kind of a complex subject. I'm going to do my best here. But just to take a step back and remind you some results from band theory, right? So if I have some complicated material, this is a hard problem to solve. But part of what makes it easier is Bloch's theorem, which says that, look, I don't have continuous translational symmetry. It's broken. But I do have this discrete translational symmetry. And that must be imprinted on the solutions, right? So I must get these set of wave functions that have this particular form. And so that means I don't have to worry about the real space picture where I look at every possible atom. Instead, I can think in k-space, right? And I only have to think in a limited region of k-space from, say, pi over a to minus pi over a. And of course, if I impose some symmetries, I really only have to worry about a few special points, these high symmetry points, at the edges of the first zone. So keep in mind, right, that really what I'm saying is that I can translate from plus k to minus k at the very edges of the zone, that I must have some periodic, my solutions must be periodic, right? So what that means is I can take this plane, and in the Hilbert space of the solutions, I can fold it up, and I get a cylinder. Now, of course, I've left out, and then I can also watch what happens to these 4 points, right? Now, what I've left out is, of course, I have to fold it in the other direction, because I still have this symmetry also in the y direction. And thus, what I get is a toroid, right? So I fold my cylinder together, and I get a toroid. And so my solutions in the Hilbert space live on a particular topology, in this case, a toroid. Now, you might say, well, that's a cute and pretty picture. Does it really mean anything? And in fact, it does. So let me walk you through how. So one can define a vector potential in equivalent with the vector potential from magnetism for the wave functions. And therefore, one can take this vector potential and take its curl, and you get the curvature of the solutions. Okay? And what Michael Berry showed was that, in fact, you can get a phase from that curvature. So what's happening is, if you take the wave function, the electron, around in this Hilbert space all the way around a closed path, it'll pick up a phase. Now, if it picks up no phase, then that's fine. It's like vacuum. But if it picks up a phase, it turns out that that's a phase you can't get rid of with a gauge transformation, and therefore it's actually real and physical. Okay, so so in other words, right, if I take it around a closed path, right, I should get, from the curvature of the solutions, I should get something that I can measure. Now, nothing I've said says that it has to be this nice, pretty toroid, right? It could have been something a little more delicious with a slightly twisted topology. And if that were the case, clearly my closed loop will change, right? My curvature will change and be different. And those are the kind of materials that we're after. Okay, so let me show you, let me skip this slide, sorry, in interest of time. So hopefully you'll just believe me that that's actual, real, and physical. Okay, so what happens is you can have a material, right? And normally that's just an insulator we would think of as basically the same as vacuum. There are no excitations of zero energy, right? So in other words, it has this donut, this toroidal topology of its solutions. However, under certain conditions, you can find insulators where their topology is twisted. It's different than in vacuum. And it's not so easy. It turns out you'd have to basically have a phase transition, a symmetry breaking, to go from one topology to the other, right? In the same way that, you know, a sphere and a cup are different, I have to poke a hole through the sphere, right? And so what happens is you generate new states at the surface that come from this broken topology at the surface. So rather than having something new generated by a change in phase, having something new come out of a phase transition, what we're actually getting is something new coming out of a change in the topology of the solutions of our material. So I think that's quite exciting. It's really a new and different way to explore materials. Of course, there have been a lot of very exciting predictions that you might find magnetic monopoles and so-called anions, which have both a electric and magnetic charge to them. I might have spent too much time in California because I always want to say you can find marijuana fermions. It's actually Majorana fermions. So these Majorana fermions are basically electrons and holes. They're their own antiparticle, and they were predicted in 37, and yet have never been observed. And it's been suggested that if you could put a superconductor on this material and get that superconductor to have a proximity effect, you could generate these Majorana fermions. Okay, but clearly most of the interesting physics happens at the surface. And we're used to, you know, in condensed matter, many of our probes are really bulk probes. So it's been a challenge to figure out how to probe these surface states. And in our group, our approach has been exfoliation, not surprising, giving the talk. But basically, by exfoliating on mica, we've been able to make the thinnest bismuth selenide published. So I'm just showing you some AFM images, showing you how thin we've been able to get it and how pretty it is, et cetera, et cetera. But basically, just like in BISCO, we get nice flat surfaces. We get reasonable-sized crystals. This one turned out to be harder to exfoliate than BISCO. But nonetheless, we've been able to get it down to 2 nanometers. And just like before, we want to do Raman spectroscopy to find out what happens to this material. Does any chemistry occur? So let me just walk you through the photon spectrum quickly. This material has inversion symmetry. That means that Raman active photons won't show up in an infrared experiment and vice versa. Infrared photons don't show up in Raman. And all of those modes were more or less well known. Here is the Raman data from the bulk. We see essentially two of the modes because of our low energy cutoff. We see the tail of an EG mode, and we see an A1G mode following all the all the symmetry considerations we'd expect. And we also see a big broad mode, which is a 2-phonon mode. Now we start thinning it out, and we start to see a large increase in our Raman intensity. It turns out that, we believe, is kind of boring. It's just essentially, again, an interference effect similar to the visibility, but now showing up in the Raman spectrum. However, if you were paying careful attention, which I'm sure you weren't because it's the end of the talk, basically what we find is that when we try to fit this data with the same set of modes that we used for the bulk, it doesn't work. you can kind of see a very small difference between our fit and the data. There's this sort of little shoulder there. And it turns out that there's an extra mode underneath that we've been able to find. So what we do is we add this extra mode, and we can perfectly fit the data, and we find that this mode has the exact same frequency as an infrared active mode along the c-axis. So how can that be? I told you we have an inversion symmetry here. We shouldn't be able to see infrared modes in Raman. Well, it turns out that that's actually not exactly true. If you have any built-in electric fields near your surface, we call it so-called band bending, then you can break the inversion symmetry and infrared modes become Raman active. And in fact, that's been seen in semiconductors. And it should be true here because we know we have surface states. So that means the electron density at the surface must be different than in the bulk. Therefore, you must have band bending. Therefore, it actually wasn't that surprising that we saw a surface phonon mode. But nonetheless, we can use Raman both to see this surface phonon mode and also as a way of telling how thick our crystals are, both from the intensity and, it turns out, the intensity of this mode. And also, we were very excited to see recently there was a helium scattering study showing that, in fact, this is a surface phonon mode that they could see sort of indirectly. Okay, in the last few minutes, I'm going to very quickly show you some coming attractions, maybe either coming into the literature soon or maybe hopefully next time I give a talk here, you will know the results, as will I, hopefully. So I mentioned that this is a very flexible technique, right, that I don't have to worry about strain. And we wanted to test that idea, and so we have. So this is what we've been starting to do is to exfoliate on a wide variety of substrates. So here, what I'm, I guess, not showing you, because you can barely see it, is a 6.5 unit cell BISCO crystal sitting on strontium titanate. Now, in truth, in fairness, you could actually have grown this, but then you need an MBE machine, and I don't have one. Okay, what you couldn't have grown is we've been able to put BISCO down on gold and a variety of other metals, and in fact, atomically flat golds. So, and we get very, very nice, pretty crystals, which produce the Raman data I showed you earlier. We could also do it on hafnia dioxide, which has been very popular with Intel in all of our chips these days for our FETs. And in addition, one that we're a little bit proud of that came recently, we've been able to do this on porous polycarbonate. Now, what this means is we have polycarbonate, a very flexible material, that has a hole that's 8 microns wide that goes all the way through the substrate. So when we put our exfoliated piece down, there's a region that's completely free of the substrate. And so we can actually probe it on and off that region with our Raman laser and look for differences to see how the substrate interacts with that crystal. And we've done that now for both BISCO, graphene, and topological insulators. Okay, is it easy? No, in a word. There are some challenges. So one you can see clearly here, right, is visibility. Right? We can put it on, roughly speaking, any substrate, but it doesn't mean we can always find what we've put down, right? However, this is a fairly tractable problem. We know how to calculate the interference effect, and then we know what to do once we do the calculation. We find the right substrate with the right parameters, and or we look in the right wavelength range where the visibility is best. However, there's a slightly harder problem which we don't understand, which is how do these two things stick together? Right? How is it that the substrate actually peels off this nano-thick crystal, and how can we optimize that? Right? So if we really want to have high yield, large area pieces, how do we ultimately optimize that interaction? And also, it might be that we don't want it to be too optimized, right? We want the substrate to sort of be there, but maybe not be there too much, right? We don't want it to squeeze our crystal or anything like that. So one of the things we've worked on a lot is what are the right procedures, right? What are the best ways to cleave? How do we prepare the substrate? Are there things we should or shouldn't do? Are there atmospheres we should work in or not work in? These kind of things. And the last challenge, which, to be honest, I'm the most excited about, is if it's really true that we can put any two things together, and when I say things, I don't literally mean any material, but that we can put any two, if you want, properties together, what are the right combinations, right? What are the two materials that we should take and find a combination of, right? So if we can really put these high-temperature superconductors on any kind of substrate, what are the right substrates? So along those lines, again, because I spent too much time in California looking for Majorana fermions, we decided to try BISCO on bismuth selenide. Now, at first, it sounds crazy, right? Why would you put, what makes you think if you stick these two things together, anything's going to happen? But if you think about it, they're both layered materials. They both cleave. You can produce a very flat surface. And in fact, my students have been able to do that. So what we found is that if we prepare it just right, we can actually see a proximity effect on the topological insulator from the high temperature superconductor. So what we've done is to build up our own DIDV transport setup. I'm not going to bore you with the details. And these are the kind of spectra that we get. So as we cool down and we look at the DIDV, so basically you're seeing the conductance spectrum versus voltage, what we see here is a peak at zero, which is indicating that our Cooper pairs in our superconductor can actually find their way directly into our topological insulator. That's great. That's the first stage in making a proximity effect. But it doesn't tell you that there's superconductivity. So then we actually, when we get to the lowest temperature, see two other features that come from the superconducting gap. One of them is from the superconducting gap of the BISCO, and the other is from the superconducting gap of the bismuth selenide. And that's what we find fairly convincing as evidence that we've in fact induced a high temperature proximity effect in bismuth selenide. That looks like it's a factor of 10 higher than any other group has managed to do. Okay, let me take a minute or two just to tell you one or two other things. So these are what some of those crystals look like. And you might imagine that everyone chooses to focus on this surface because it's big, it's cleavable, it's nice to work with. In our group, we like to do things the difficult way, and so we've looked at the other surface, right? And it's not just because it's difficult, it's really because you might expect that even if you have bulk contributions, your surface states should be different on different surfaces of your crystal, especially if you know your crystal's anisotropic. And so our hope was that if we look at different surfaces, we may be able to pull out, tease out what the surface states are doing. So here is some data from this other surface that looks very similar to the data that's been collected on this big flat surface. Basically, you see a nice Drude response telling you that it's a pretty decently doped semiconductor. However, again, another advantage of optics, which is a contactless probe, is we can simply rotate the polarizer and look at the other direction. And we've done that, and we found that, as you might expect for a layered material, the C-axis is actually quite a bit more insulating, so you see this plasma edge moves to lower energies. And that's actually quite useful. We hope that that means that the C-axis is going to be a much more promising way to get rid of any bulk contribution and instead focus on the surface. Lastly, we've been working with Lauren Whitehead to develop a technique so we can do so-called attenuated total internal reflection using half spherical domes in our FTIR. We've also been doing spectroscopy at the CLS, so we've been able to see changes in different exfoliated crystals with different doping levels, so we can actually measure the reflectivity and transmission, and you can see quite a dramatic change from, say, an optimally doped crystal from an underdoped crystal, and so we're hoping to use this as a way to probe the electronic states in these materials. And last, but certainly not least, we've been working with Yongjun Kim, really it's been his group doing it, but we provided the samples, so I guess I get to show the data. So what they've done is they go to CLS, and they have a micro-diffraction X-ray beam, and they run their beam all around this picture here. Okay, so this is the optical microscope image. This is the fluorescence image. So they see X-ray fluorescence coming from different layers, and the fluorescence pretty much matches the microscope image. Then they can park their X-ray beam somewhere on that on a particular exfoliated piece and take a Lowy diffraction picture. It looks like this. And I'm not going to show you, but basically it looks the same as the bulk. So that was great. It told us that, in fact, when we exfoliate these materials, that they do retain the bulk lattice structure. And what we're now hoping to do is more careful studies to really look in detail at whether that lattice structure relaxes in some way as you thin it out. So to summarize, I hope I've convinced you that Scotch tape is a fun way to play around in physics. You can make lots of interesting materials in new and combinations, and you can do it and be a first author if you're an undergrad in this case, or if you just want to use a glove box, you don't need a complicated MBE machine. However, when you do that, you have to be careful, and so we found that with Raman spectroscopy, we see a large change in the magnetic interactions of our exfoliated materials that we think is due to a change in the doping level. And also, in our topological insulators, we've been able to use this to identify a mode on the surface, and we're now hoping to use exfoliation as a way to look at the surface states. And last but not least, we're always happy to collaborate with good people, which I know you all are. So thank you for your attention, and be happy to answer any questions.